I can't even believe it. You looked God in the eye and you said, it was okay. Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
Those were just really good claps.
They were pretty good claps.
One day that's going to be obsolete.
Do you know when you're dealing with people, when I'm dealing with people as an adult, I have learned that if you ask people for an opinion, right, there are so many ways in which asking people a question makes you vulnerable in ways you only learn later in life.
Never ask for the opinion. Tell them something.
Yeah.
And just say, and just wait for them to confirm you.
See, I did that for a long time, and then people said I was an asshole. So I stopped doing that. The never soliciting opinions and just always sharing yours.
Oh, well, so I don't share my opinion unless genuinely asked for. And frankly, there's my verbal tick.
You're not supposed to tell people.
I have been asked maybe 2 or 3 times in my life for my honest opinion of somebody's artwork that was a close friend of mine. And we had a really constructive conversation. But until you're asked, yeah, I think you keep that stuff to yourself. Well, and I've also had friends unsolicited give me their opinion on stuff that I didn't ask for. And I had to stop and be like, I can't. I have a process. And unless I'm asking for an opinion, it's going to mess up my process.
Well, so the thing I always try to do when somebody asks for feedback is, because we get this a lot from friends who are making friends who are making apps all the way up to, right, hey, I made this. Do you think it's any good? And you have to first go through the process. Like, are they looking for just positive reinforcement or do they want actual feedback?
It's good that you made it.
And
Have you read the No, I Won't Read Your Fucking Screenplay?
No.
It's a blog post from a few years ago by a screenwriter who basically just said, there is no percentage in me reading your screenplay. It's valuable time of mine. Mm-hmm. It's 2 hours of my time and I work for a living. But more than that, I seriously doubt you want my genuine opinion. Because your screenplay is probably terrible, as most of them are. And if I give, he's in his experience, when he gave his honest opinion, he lost friends. Like, people would say, oh, what do you think? And he'd be like, this is terrible. Your whole first act is a mess. The characters don't make any sense and I don't like the plot. And they'd be like, the hell with you.
Well, but that's
and every screenwriter, I'm sure everyone they meet, they're counting down to the day that that person hands them a screenplay.
Oh, yeah.
Can you give me your opinion? Can you pass this on to someone? You know,
you've had people hand you their novel to read.
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh my God, it's so terrible.
But you know, sometimes you find something that's wonderful.
It's
like I have had friends say, hey, I wrote a novel, will you read it? And it's been absolutely stunning. Really, really good. Self-published, sold like 8 copies.
Yeah.
I agree.
There are good and bad, but people don't recognize enough what a tricky situation it can be.
Well, so here's the difference is I'm coming at it. Most of my friends are writers or have editorial backgrounds. So they're used to being edited. I mean, the first thing you learn when you go in to work at a magazine or at a website where there's
Someone's
an editorial process is like
you're writing.
Your shit is going to get broken down every single day. And eventually you'll get good because of that.
Exactly. But when an acquaintance or even a friend who is dabbling in that art hands you a piece, they need to be really clear. Like if you hand somebody a piece of writing, you need to be really clear about what you're hoping to get.
And we should also be clear, someone giving you a piece of something to evaluate and giving me and Will something, completely different.
Well, it's
I'm not in a position to validate anyone.
Well, no, yes, you are. Yeah. And it all depends upon the medium.
Screenplay, in terms of a screenplay.
Right, you know, I don't know. Actually, I have friends who don't write who are unbelievable commenters on screenplays. They're just really good at sensing plot. They don't write screenplays themselves, but they're awesome readers.
Right.
And actually, most of the screenwriters I know have friends like that they hand to because they want to get an honest breakdown. I guess the long and the short of it is, if you hand your stuff to anybody who is a friend for a free evaluation, you need to be clear that that is a thorny, tricky situation. And you should think through the responses you might get. Like, they may not like it. And if they don't, you should give them the space to be able to say that. Like,
and, so you know what you're asking for, and you know the value of what you're asking for.
Yeah.
And also, it reminds
it's not to my taste. That's a really, that's a good out.
it's not to my taste. John August, who is a screenwriter, he wrote Big Fish and I think like 10 other, nine other movies. He has a Kickstarter going on right now for aspiring screenwriters. And it's a flashcard kit that he designed because he gives consults all the time. And he runs a podcast about screenwriting, screenplay writing, and very active in the screenplay community and the screenwriter community and forums. And it's all these like interesting ideas and ways to get out of, you know,
holes
of when you're writing.
Oh, nice.
And I think it's like $15 or something, and you get all these great ideas and
ways
and just like pitfalls of screenwriting and nice little
corners you
set.
Paint yourself into. Yeah. So this was written by Josh Olson, and it was, he wrote A History of Violence.
Okay.
And it's a Village Voice. He's a Village Voice contributor. I think it was actually in the Village Voice blog, and it's called No, I Will Not Read Your Fucking Script. If that seems unfair, I'll make you a deal. In return for you not asking me to read your fucking script, I will not ask you to wash my fucking car or take my fucking picture or represent me in court or take out my gallbladder or whatever the hell it is you do for a living.
Well, but that's kind of a different thing. That's like the Mike Montero thing, that which is that design is a job, and just because you do a job that is intangible in some way, shape, or form, you should be compensated for that in every way possible.
I had a
photographers
friend,
have the same problem.
Yeah, and I had a friend who was an antique dealer, and I remember going to him because one of the shows, I don't know, maybe it was 2020, had a thing about how antique dealers in New York are ripping people off. So they would take a artifact to them and they say, how much is this worth? And they would know that the artifact was worth $5,000. And the guy would go, this is worth $100. And it was like, oh, shocking. And my friend, I told my friend the antique dealer, and he was like, that is such a bullshit story. And I said, why? And he goes, well, look, first of all, the appraisal you get is worth what you pay for it. And actually, appraising is probably about a fifth of my income, he said. And I make it by doing real research with real knowledge that I've gathered over 30 years in this business. That is worth something. And I charge for it. I charge $100 an hour for an appraisal. And when I give you an appraisal, I will stand by it and defend it to anybody. But if you come and ask me for free, I'm going to give an off-the-cuff response. But more than that, here's the other reason it's a bullshit story. Everyone loves this. I bought it at a garage sale for a quarter, and it's worth $80,000 because it's a comic book that no one knows is really valuable.
Right.
What about the garage sale? Effectively, you just ripped off the person at the garage sale because you had knowledge they didn't.
Only for $79,999.25.
And he's totally right. Basically, these things have value. These appraisals have value, and they're not.
And in often case, the value comes from the appraisal.
It can.
Because absolutely. The appraisal is what dictates what people want to pay for.
Well, exactly.
But also the person doing the appraisal, your friend who is the antiques dealer, had a network of people, and he could look at it and say, oh, I know that John over on 48th Street will pay $5,000 for this today because it's the kind of thing that he is really into.
And
that adds to it as well.
And also, these are very, very spongy things. He once showed me, this antiques dealer friend, showed me two things, and he said, one of these is fake and one of them is real. And by fake, it's 50 years old instead of 300
right.
years old. And I looked at it and I was like, this one feels a little deeper to me. I can't describe it any more than that. And he's like, no, you're right. That's the one that's more, that's the one that's real. But it is like, this is what these guys get paid to figure out is what is. But we've gone.
So what you're saying is appraising someone's work is like riding an obstacle course. It's like riding a bicycle through downtown traffic, like a bike messenger, weaving in and out of traffic, like you're Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
No, yeah,
that's all I'm saying.
I was gonna go with the computer being a bicycle for the mind.
Oh, I like that. I like that.
I think yours is better, Norm. All I can see is Joseph Gordon-Levitt's like sweaty face and pedaling.
And spinning our wheels.
Okay. Oh, spinning our wheels. Nice.
Wow.
So, yeah, we wanted to talk about
worst
bicycles.
Worst segue ever. Well, no, actually, the segue from a couple of weeks ago was the worst segue ever. This is the second worst segue ever.
So, bicycles. I'm having a bicycle renaissance in San Francisco.
I noticed, like, oftentimes we come to the shop and we'll see your car parked out front on the sidewalk or in the street.
Yeah.
And then there'll be like three tickets on it because the meter maid has a vendetta against
you.
They're
just awful.
They've declared Canley.
I know. Anyway, so I stopped parking my car here.
Good policy.
I only live a couple blocks away. I ferry lots of stuff back and forth, which is the main reason I'll drive over here because I'm a firm believer in take something everywhere you go, right? So I don't ever go from upstairs to downstairs in my house without carrying something that should go downstairs, a dish, a thing, you know, something that's out of its place. And I try not to go between the shop and the house without ferrying stuff back and forth. It's, you know, organization is a bear.
That's a really interesting way I think about it. Like, you should never go up. Why waste the trip if you have the hands?
Precisely. Never go with your hands empty.
Precisely. Yeah. Even from the, like, from room to room. Yeah, no, it's a really, really nice technique, because at the end of the day, you'll find you've done a lot of actual extra work. But because the meter maids out here are dicks, look, I know that's a hard job, and I am not trashing meter maids, but the meter maids out here are dicks.
San Francisco meter maids in general. I mean, and also probably meter maids isn't the appropriate term when I think about it.
Right. It's not Lovely Rita anymore.
Right. No, Lovely Rita is a bearded man in a three-wheel scooter.
I recognize. We are still chained to the patriarchal names that we gave everything back in the swinging 60s.
Okay, so here's the thing. The not cops that drive the scooters that give parking tickets.
The interceptors.
You know, every
I mean, maybe they're JV cops.
The
I don't know.
Cops. Anyway, I've been riding my bike, and I have this beautiful bike I bought a few years ago. A Trek District. It's carbon fiber. Mm-hmm. It's very light. And it's a single speed, which I was shocked works for me. I really wasn't planning on buying a single speed. In fact, I bought a geared hub with a 8-speed hub to put inside of it, because I liked the idea of that instead of a derailleur. And just before Valencia Cyclery, which has been my bicycle shop for 25 years, just before they put the hub in, I took the Trek District for a test ride, and I was like, single speed's totally fine.
It's not a fixed speed.
It's not a fixie, okay. No.
So you have, like, the rear wheel has sprockets and it spins and all
exactly.
that stuff.
Okay. But it's a single speed bike, and it's geared just perfectly for San Francisco, for, I guess, my strength ratio. So I've actually gone through the Wiggle. I've gone to the other side of the city. I've gone to Ghirardelli Square on this bike from the Mission.
Explain the Wiggle for people who don't know
what's the Wiggle.
Oh, okay, so San Francisco is full of hills, and it can be difficult to map. And there are apps like Bike Mapper, which, if you put in your destination, will actually show you the flattest route to get there.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. And it'll route you around some of the hidden hills. San Francisco is full of big hills, but it's also full of hidden hills that can tucker you out, like Guerrero Street, right? Mm-hmm. Like, will kick your ass.
Yeah.
Valencia won't. But the Wiggle is even more than that. The Wiggle is a codified route from here up to Golden Gate, from the Mission or Lower Haight up to Golden Gate Park in the flattest way possible. And it's actually arrowed and painted onto the street.
Really?
Yeah. And it's this little checkerboard sort of, it's called the Wiggle because
it's not intuitive at all.
No.
You have to zigzag back and forth in blocks to avoid to do gentle grades.
You don't ever backtrack, but you're effectively what New Yorkers would call checkerboarding. You
okay.
know, make a right, make a left, make a right, make a left, go three blocks, make a right, make a left. Okay. You have a long, gentle climb on Fell Street, and then bang, you're at the park.
Yep. Huh. Our one-way streets facilitate that.
Yes. So the single speed has been great. And, you know, we're a family. We have bicycles. We've ridden our bicycles all over the place, but I haven't ridden in a while. And then over the past couple of months, you know, I've been hiking more. I've been getting in shape. I've been replacing some of my fat with some muscle, which feels great. And the bicycle's been a part of that. So a couple of weeks ago, I went and got a brand new big saddle seat that fits my ass better and is much more comfortable. And I got some new handlebars, and I put new brakes on it because I modify everything.
You're maintaining and improving.
I'm a modder,
yes.
Right? And now I'm loving it. I went to a doctor's appointment on the bicycle. What is healthy?
So to get rid of verbal
tech. Doctor's appointment on a bicycle.
You could have been eating an apple at the same time.
And when I got there, my blood pressure, 106 over 70. Bam!
Yeah, it turns out if you take the time that you're sitting in your ass in the car away and change that into actively moving, it's good for you.
Hey,
who would have thought?
But I wanted to talk about bicycles because I have always been a bicycle person. When I was a teenager, oh, actually, this is a good story. I've never told this story before. I used to have the big banana seat bikes, right?
Yes.
With coaster brakes.
I had one of those
as a kid.
Like the
Schwinn-type bicycles in the mid-70s.
Is coaster brakes when you push backwards on the pedal and it stops?
Yep.
Oh, my God.
That's what I started with.
Coaster brakes.
Yeah.
So when I was, God, probably 11 or 12. Let's see. Wait a second. Third grade, fourth grade. Yeah. Yeah, it's probably 11 or 12. My parents decided to upgrade me, and we were poor. We didn't have real money. But we had some friends, the Goldmans, who were storing a bunch of stuff at our house, and the Goldmans lent us a 10-speed bicycle, and my parents worked with them to give me this 10-speed bicycle. And I lived near the Hudson River in Tarrytown, New York, on a little hill, right? So from my house was like a gentle slope down to the Hudson River over 3.5 blocks.
So for me, when I was a kid,
yeah,
the transition from the one speed, first the banana bikes and then the BMX bikes, to the 10 speed,
yeah,
that was transition to adulthood.
That's what I felt like.
Right.
That's what I felt like. But nobody, here's the thing. My parents were basically just like, here's the 10 speed. And I was like, oh, cool. And I got on it and I didn't know about the handbrakes.
Oh, God.
No one told me. So I get on this spindly thin thing on this slope and I go.
I'm pedaling backwards.
How do I stop? And I start pedaling backwards furiously and I'm still going. And there's like cross traffic at the bottom of the street. And my dad's running after me going, squeeze the handlebars, squeeze the handlebars. And I'm squeezing the handlebars and nothing's happening. Finally, the slope evens out. My dad catches up with me and I'm like, that bike sucks.
Wow.
Oh, my God. That's spectacular.
Yeah, so I didn't get on a 10 speed again for a while. but then when I was probably, when did, hello? Siri, wait, anyway, Siri's useless today.
Never works, it turns
when
out.
When did Breaking Away come out? Late 70s.
What's Breaking Away?
Breaking Away is a Dennis Quaid, Daniel Stern movie with Paul Dooley as the dad. It's a great film. Oh, it's a great movie. About a young bicycle racer in Bloomington, Indiana.
Ooh.
Son of a stone cutter.
Like the fraternal order or no, a person who actually cuts stone
for like
a living?
Yeah, like, so there, it
who
was
controls
a whole
the English
it's
crowd?
A class movie. Okay. So it's about these kind of wrong side of the tracks, working class kids who are friends. And this one is a bicycle racer and he's obsessed with the Italian bicycle, you know, Italian bicyclists.
Yeah.
And, it's just about him.
Like he wants to be a Tour de France style bicycle racer.
Exactly. Okay. It's a beautiful coming of age movie.
79.
Okay.
Wow, they're wearing shirts that say Cutters.
Yeah. 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 So they're called, that's it. They're called the Cutters. And, you know, as opposed to the elite cycling teams, these guys are real working class. But it's a great movie. Really,
it still holds up.
Breaking Away.
Breaking Away.
And around the time that came out, my sister, Chris, gave me her old Parasport bicycle. Remember Parasport?
Mm-mm.
That was an old bicycle company, an old French bicycle company. And we had a bicycle store in town called Sleepy Hollow Bicycle, and all the guys were totally ectomorphic, you know, tight shirts and the thin shoes, and they, you know, they raced all weekend long.
Skinny tops and enormous legs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Frog's legs, yeah, yeah. Right? And I kept on bringing my 10-speed in. This is now I'm like 14, 13. I kept bringing my 10-speed in to have the flat tire repaired. And, you know, it costs like $3 every time. And finally he was like, I'm just, come here. And he showed me, using the wedge tools to pop the tire off, how to fix a flat. Both how to replace the inner tube, but also how to actually patch the inner tube. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, that's cool. I like that. That's fun. So I started doing that. Then Breaking Away came out. And Breaking Away has this long scene where he takes this shitty bicycle and makes it good. And it's just this beautiful craftsman. It's the transition between
it's
Act
the montage.
2 and
yeah,
Act
yeah.
3 montage. And he's sitting there, you know, tightening things and making the bike into a precision instrument.
Right, right.
And I liked that. So I started modding the Parasport. I started, you know, I'd get a different chain or I'd get a different seat. And I started learning that actually taking a bicycle apart and putting it back together is not that difficult. It's relatively straightforward. There are some things like the headset and derailleur set that can be a little tricky, or you need specialized tools. But for the most part, it's a very parsable system.
It's like Lego. Mm-hmm. Like there's everything goes in a place.
Yeah. And then by the time I was 18 and moved to New York City, the bicycle was my oh, right. Somewhere in high school, that Parasport got stolen. And out of my backyard, I think I know who took it.
It was an inside job.
It was an inside. I had a party and these rough kids came to my party. And then like 3 days later, the bicycle was gone.
Kids from the bad side of the tracks?
Yeah.
They just needed a new racing bike.
No, they weren't from the bad side of the tracks. Okay. They were just assholes. And yet my parents had homeowner's insurance. So about 6 months later, my mom was like, hey, here's that $200 for your bike. $200 in 1980 was like, holy crap. So I went to the bike store and I was like, what can this buy me? And I bought this like 19-pound Moto Bacan Italian bicycle that is still to this day one of the most beautiful bicycles I've ever seen. It weighed, was a feather, 18 pounds. It was just like, it was nothing.
Oh, yeah.
And I commuted on that bicycle from Brooklyn to Midtown for a couple of years.
Wow.
Like, you know, eight or 10 miles a day.
Is there a bike path across like the bridge or
well,
something?
Well, there's a walking path across the Brooklyn Bridge. So you'd ride that and then up through the financial district up Fifth Avenue.
Wow.
And yeah, it was wonderful.
Did they have bike lanes back then?
No.
Oh, you were just cheating death.
No. Well,
did you wear a helmet?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is the thing about New York is that it's entirely flat.
Yeah.
And it is just a bicycle paradise. So you, the cars, the red light cycles are such that on a bicycle, you can pretty much keep up with the cars. So you sit there splitting lanes, moving between the cars. You're always looking to see. Basically, this is what I got addicted to. I loved riding in the city and I loved heavy traffic. I loved riding in the rain. I loved riding when it's hot, when it's cold, everything. I got into all of that. I had discs on my wheels. I had I painted jobs. I had mirrors on my glasses to see behind me. I was a total bike nut.
You should watch that Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie.
Yeah, that movie's great.
Oh, really?
Premium
Rush. It's fabulous.
Okay. Well, I mean,
it's terrible, but it's really good.
The thing is that you'd be like barreling up, you know, up one of the, you know, Third Avenue towards the Upper East Side in the middle of the night with the traffic hitting the green lights as they're turning green and being able to spot the people who were not going to signal but still were thinking about changing lanes. You had this like sixth sense. I mean, it was absolute joy. I loved riding a bike in New York.
We have a friend, former coworker who it was a bike messenger for years, and he always described it as, hey, it made me feel like I was high, because once you kind of get into that zone, you just feel so good and you feel like nothing can stop you, and then somebody opens their car door and you completely eat shit.
I never ate it against a car door. I had a couple of accidents, but the high point for me was, I think, early 1989, my parents were going to go to their Christmas party in Sneeden's Landing, where my mom grew up, which is right across the Hudson River from Dobbs Ferry.
These don't sound like real names, Adam.
I know. And Sneeden's.
Sleepy Hollow, sure.
And my parents called me in Brooklyn. And they said, do you want to come to the Norman's Christmas party, which was the big Christmas event of the year in my grandmother's neighborhood there? Mm-hmm. And I was like, yes. And they were like, we don't have time to come pick you up in Brooklyn. And I was like, OK, I will meet you at 168th and Broadway, which is where you can go get on the George Washington Bridge. Yeah. So they would come up from Westchester, stop there, pick me up and head out to Sneeden's. And that would all work out. Except I didn't have a dollar for the subway because I was poor and I was an idiot.
Wow.
So I jumped on my bicycle. Now, for geography, I seriously did this. I made it from Park Slope, Brooklyn, 8th Avenue and Carroll Street to 168th and Broadway in 51 minutes.
That's amazing.
I was averaging something like 17 miles an hour.
Yeah, that's crazy.
All the way. That was the pinnacle of my...
Were you riding on sidewalks and stuff?
I was everything.
It was basically like the Die Hard 3 with the cab.
Quicksilver. Kevin Bacon movie, Quicksilver, in which they're barreling down one of the avenues in New York and all of a sudden they're coming down Fillmore.
Oh, boy.
And then they're back in New York. Hilarious. But, you know, I rode a bicycle hundreds and hundreds of miles a week, practically.
Yeah.
Not hundreds and hundreds, but, you know, maybe 100 miles a week in New York. And I really, really was addicted to it. But when I first moved out to San Francisco, the neighborhood I moved into was the Western Addition, Broadrick and Golden Gate,
mm-hmm.
top of a hill.
Mm-hmm.
Bicycling home sucked.
Yeah.
And so I stopped riding. And over the past few weeks, as I've been, you know,
So 20 years pass,
and all of a sudden I'm riding again. Number one, bike lanes everywhere.
Everywhere.
And they are dreamy. Harrison, Folsom.
They're painted green.
17th Street. Mm-hmm. They're really clear, and bicyclists are on them, and cars are actually looking for you. It's wonderful.
And it's not even a ton of bicyclists either.
No.
It's roomy, spacious.
More, and I want more. I want San Francisco to be more of a bike city. But so I'm having a bicycle renaissance.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm.
It's a combination of, you know, you want to be fit, and also parking sucks.
Parking sucks.
I mean, you have the easiest parking car you can have that's not a smart car, basically.
It's true. Yeah, the Fiat 500.
You can almost pull in nose first.
Almost nose first, except you block the sidewalk, and my neighbors got upset about that, and I apologize for doing that, and I have never done it since.
Okay, that's good. Anyway.
I had a bike. I biked all through college. I still have that bike. Probably the frame's a little dented, so...
What was your commute?
I lived in college, and I didn't have a car there.
Oh, okay. So you just biked everywhere.
So you lived on campus.
I lived a mile off campus.
Okay. And
biked, and getting the light bike, getting a nice Trek. I got a hybrid, which is like between a road bike and a mountain bike.
Yeah.
And I love that bike. And, you know, back when you were a kid, you get your 10 speed, and then the higher number of speeds, it was like it's point of pride. Like, I have a 30 speed.
Right? Yeah.
I have a 15 speed. And it really didn't matter. And the best thing you can do is get a bike, because you're growing so fast, is getting a bike that matches your height.
Right.
It's getting one that when you stand on, you know, just in your tippy toes, that you can extend your leg fully.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do remember that the Motobacon crapped out on me somewhere in probably 88. And then I had a good paying job at a graphic design studio. And I spent an entire paycheck, $750, on a brand new Cannondale. Back when Cannondale was first out, that big fat aluminum frame. And that bike got stolen from me. It got taken from 5th Avenue at 20th Street at noon on a Tuesday.
Wow.
They used a 2x4 to shatter the kryptonite lock.
Yeah.
And rode away on a flat back tire. And I called Kryptonite because the lock is insured for up to $500 or something like that for a theft. And they said, you got the receipt. Great. Yeah. You got the serial number. Yeah. You have the pieces of the broken lock. Yes, I do. Okay, great. And the address the bike was stolen from, 5th and 20th Street.
Oh,
what? You didn't read the fine print, but Kryptonite locks are insured everywhere in the world except for the island of Manhattan.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
It was such a hotbed of bike thievery that they were like, no, we can't do it here.
Later on, Kryptonite released a lock called the New Yorker that they would insure on Manhattan.
Did they do the same lock? They just charge more for it?
No, I think they actually... The fact is that you really can bust a bar lock with a 2x4 properly levered against a stop sign.
Yeah.
If a bike thief wants to steal your bike, they can do it.
Well, locks in general are deterrents. They're not... They don't... If you want to get past any kind of lock, you can get past a lock.
Yeah, no, this is totally true. It is a deterrent, and you wouldn't leave your bike out overnight anywhere ever. You know, it's for the 15 minutes you're in the store or the hour that you're having lunch while it's parked right outside. Those are the safe ways. But I mourn that Cannondale. I would love to find another early Cannondale and build it back into the hybrid road bike.
Mm.
Will, bike stories?
So I grew up on a small farm in the country. And the road to our farm was the kind of windy-ass back country road that doesn't have streetlights or sidewalks.
And the Dixie Chicks write about.
I don't know about the Dixie. I'm not familiar. Nice try, though. It was the kind of road that either you go like 5 miles an hour on a tractor or 70 miles an hour. So we were strictly forbidden from riding on the road.
Oh, wow.
In our neighborhood. So I grew up and we started with that banana bike that I think mom or dad got at like a flea market or, you know, wherever. It was it was a pass down.
Oh, your kids for going out.
Your
with
kids could
kids
use a bike.
In trouble.
Yeah, except for there were no other kids around to get into trouble with. So I learned to ride in fields, not yard.
Wow.
Not driveway. Fields, like hay fields, the kind of fields that you mow with hay.
That's terrible.
Oh, it was awful. I mean, it was great because when you wiped out, you didn't get all skinned up, which I guess was a formative experience for most people. And we had a gravel driveway that was about between an eighth and a quarter of a mile long. So we could ride up and down that, but there wasn't a whole lot of excitement there. And then when I was probably 8 or 9, the BMX thing took off. and we happened to have, you know, we had big piles of dirt all over the place, and I was in charge of mowing certain parts of the place by then. So I mowed a BMX, you know, nice. Dad and I piled up a bunch of dirt and we built a bunch of jumps, and like I rode BMX.
Nice.
And then that turned into riding like freestyle bikes, and I did the things with the sticks on the side and all that
spun
for a little bit. Spin the handlebars. I was never very good at that. But I never really learned to ride on the street at all. So like I would go to friends' houses occasionally and mom and dad would chuck the bike in the back and we'd go ride around in somebody's subdivision.
Yeah.
But like any place that there's traffic is really scary for me because I'm not a proficient,
right.
I'm a proficient enough biker that I can go up ramps and jumps and stuff like that, but going in a straight line, pretty hard, it turns out. So I don't really have, I am not a very good bicyclist.
I have a bicycle story. When I bought this Trek, I guess we'd been here about a year and a half. So this is like 4 years ago. And I walked up Valencia Street. And I've been shopping at Valencia Cyclery for 25 years. It's a wonderful store. But I also was interested this other bike store had opened up.
You're cheating.
Nearby. Well, I was just, you know, what do they have? So I walked in and I was like, what do you have? And they were like, well, what kind of riding are you doing? Well, I'm mostly city. Okay, you probably want a hybrid, right? They, you know, they're going to sell me on a hybrid. And I was like, okay, yeah, these are all really ugly. My problem is, they're really ugly. So do you have something else? And they were like, well, we really recommend the hybrid. And I was like, okay, I'll see you guys later. Because that's, I wasn't asking for that.
Yeah.
I already made it clear that I'd want something else. And they basically were kind of, this is, I'm not saying this is the store, this was the salesperson.
Well, but bike stores are intimidating. Because like, especially if you're not into bikes, there's a whole lingo there. You know, yes. It's like going to a ski shop or any place that's like a specialized sports store. If you're just starting out, and you're not secure enough to say, hey, I have no idea what I'm looking for. I don't want to spend a ton of money.
But this
here's what I want.
I agree with you. And this is why I love Valencia Cyclery, because they really do cater to the whole range. And they really are all really sweet and knowledgeable.
Can you buy like a $200, $100 bike at Valencia Cyclery?
Well, $100
$200 bike.
I think you probably can buy on the lower end. They also have some used bikes for sale over in the repair shop.
I would only buy used bikes. No, I wouldn't want to buy a new bike.
No.
Especially get started. I mean, Craigslist, people are getting rid of their bikes all the time.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Garage sales and Craigslist are great resources for purchasing.
Kayaks, bicycles. Canoes, bikes, skis, snowboards.
and weights.
Oh, weights, yeah.
Exercise equipment. That's
If you want to buy
it for a week.
You want an elliptical? 50% off.
My other term for an elliptical is a hat rack.
Oh, yeah, it has the two posts. That's good.
Because
the finger trap hat rack.
Yeah.
I'm really pleased to the degree to which not only is San Francisco becoming much more of a bike city, but the degree to which, you know, blogs like Boing Boing are pushing wonderful studies that show when European cities actually cut down on the lanes for cars and add bicycle lanes, it incrementally affects the traffic. So it does make the traffic maybe 5% heavier, which is a very small number, but it makes the city a lot greener because a lot more people start commuting on bicycles.
Well, I mean,
and it's better not only from a green perspective, but also from an overall population health perspective. People who are out there on bicycles are getting their heart rate up. That's really good for the whole system.
Well, one of the things, like especially in a city like San Francisco, where there are very clearly roads that you never want to be on a bicycle, like Fell Street, east of say Fillmore, Steiner, or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Like I've long thought that like if you look at like Pine and Oak, those are two streets that go they're main thoroughfares east and west through the city.
Mm-hmm.
They're one way each way. There's no reason one of those lanes shouldn't just be a bicycle lane.
Yeah, it's true.
And that's just becomes the main look at where bicycles want to ride and give them a main thoroughfare east
and
west.
That may actually be. There are some bike lanes on Fell towards the park, right?
Yeah.
The Wiggle actually gives you a lane on the left side of Fell, if I'm correct.
Yes.
South side.
The scary side.
The scary
side. It's the side where all the cars open.
Yeah. Right. I'm now that I've talked about that old Cannondale, I'm kind of like thinking, I wonder if I could buy a vintage Cannondale frame.
eBay.
Here we go.
Just don't join those jerks who block all the traffic.
What's that?
Critical mass?
Critical mass.
Oh, you know, no. No, a critical mass is not really happening very much anymore,
no,
is it?
I think
it happened on Halloween.
Right, right, because that was the last Friday. And a few years ago, actually now it would be 10 years ago, Halloween also fell on a Friday. Last Friday of the month.
Oh, yeah.
And that was awesome because critical mass was at its peak and all of the critical mass was in costume. And I remember I was driving with my friend Sophie in her VW, which had a sunroof, and I was dressed as the Pope. Except Except I had a neon.
I think we're good here. See you guys next week.
I had a neon mitre with a neon cross.
Okay.
I was Wedding Chapel Pope.
That's good.
And we're like on Valencia Street, and all of a sudden critical mass is coming towards us, and there's like three bicycles chained together as a dragon and people with lights. It was incredible. So I opened the sunroof and I stood up and I turned the VW into a Pope mobile and I started giving benedictions to everyone as the Pope. People are ding, 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 ding as they go by. It was phenomenal.
Did they do critical ass then? Do you guys, about critical ass, right? It's the nudist contingent of critical mass. So it's a bunch of kind of middle-aged, heavy guys.
Look, bodies are bodies.
Bodies are beautiful.
Where they put their wallets.
They have a little saddle, I'm sure.
Fanny packs.
Yeah, fanny packs.
Lots of fanny packs. Utility belts.
You could use one of those testicle purses.
No, thanks.
You know the one that
No, we're good. Thanks. I think we can't talk about bicycles without talking about law-abiding bicycle riding.
This is actually a pet peeve of mine, right? Because I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem with rolling through an intersection on a bicycle when there's no cars around,
mm-hmm.
right? That to me is just what you do on a bicycle. That's all right. But what gets me in San Francisco, both as a cyclist and as a driver, is bicycles that are constantly switching their own perception of themselves. Now I'm a pedestrian. Now I'm on a bicycle. Now I'm a pedestrian. Now I'm a bicycle.
The old crosswalk bike lane switcheroo.
And it's really problematic, mostly because what keeps us all safe on the road is being predictable. That's the primary thing. And it's the thing I tell my kids because they're about to start getting their learner's permit. The main thing is you have to be predictable. And if you're not, you're dangerous. And when bicyclists are weaving in and out, it's very hard when they're doing that and then rolling through and becoming a pedestrian and then riding the wrong way down a sidewalk to all of a sudden cross a street you're turning left on. And you're not looking there.
Yeah.
That's the one place you're not looking. Becomes really difficult.
I mean, just generally doing things like splitting rail lanes motorcyclists do the same thing. I see motorcyclists split between traffic and parked cars all the time, which
that's illegal. That's a big ticket.
Yes.
Passing on the right on a motorcycle, even when there's a bike lane,
yes.
That's not your lane, motorcycle.
Right.
I don't know the legalistics of this, but I'm pretty sure.
No, it's you're only allowed to split lanes between moving cars.
Right.
You can't split lanes between parked cars.
Oh.
But a parked car and a moving car. 99% on that. I missed the question.
The fact is that the law makes the bicycle should behave exactly like a car. Mm-hmm. And I recognize that there's more of a gray area in practice because as a cyclist, I totally will roll through a set of stop signs when there's no cars coming and it's a four-way stop.
Right.
I just consider that's part of cycling. But predictability is really important.
Car drivers, the neat thing about living here for the last 15 years is that as I've seen more and more cyclists come up and there's more bike lanes, at this point now, just checking the right anytime I turn right to make sure there's not a bicycle there is the most... one of the most ingrained things that I do as a driver.
Totally.
Super easy to learn.
Oh, yeah. And it's absolutely vital in a city that's becoming a bicycle city, especially because, you know, I'm turning on 18th and Valencia all the time because this is my neighborhood. That is like from every direction you need to be looking into your right-hand mirror.
Yeah.
And cyclists come. A lot of them don't have... Oh, here's another one. You got to keep your lights in working order.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At night, if you don't have a light, you are a death trap and your own death trap, not anyone else's.
And don't, like, lights and helmets are a place you shouldn't cheap out.
No.
Get a light that, like, if you can't see the light from 20 feet away, nobody in a car is ever going to be able to see it.
$5
Yeah.
And one AAA battery will last you for like 7 or 8 months. It's totally reasonable expense.
Stripey stuff, too.
What else is there about bicyclists to talk about?
Do you ride trails? Do you do trail riding at all?
I have never done trail riding.
See, that's what
not
I was
that interested in it.
I like going on like flat lake trails.
What do you think about bicyclists who ride outside of the bike lane in traffic when there's a bike lane?
I'm totally fine with that as long like I figure they're taking their life into their own hands.
No.
No. I mean, you're talking about like bike messenger style bike
no,
riding.
No, I'm talking about like I'm riding up Valencia and there's a bike lane full of cyclists and one of them is just drifting into the driving lane and talking to his two other friends in the bike lane.
That's bad. I'm talking about somebody who's like trying to turn left and needs to cross traffic.
I do that all the time.
Yeah.
And whenever I'm in a car lane, I'm doing it for the shortest possible period of time and signaling heavily so that everyone knows what's about to happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
I also don't like listening to music.
That's a really bad idea.
Yeah.
Headphones.
Don't get me wrong. It's a lovely thing in a quiet, empty suburban neighborhood to ride a bicycle listening to headphones. But it's also dumb because you won't be able to hear the car when it's coming at you. You need your wits about you.
If you feel like you need to listen to music, get a little boombox. Stick it on the back of your bicycle.
Don't do that
like
again.
1985. It's not. We don't endorse this idea. I think that's a pretty good.
You know, one of the things about San Francisco is if you're shopping for a bike, I agree Craigslist and garage sales are great places to look for a bike. It is also, however, a city in which bicycle thefts are a significant problem. I would caution you not to buy bicycles from somebody who set up a blanket on the street.
Oh, man, they have such good deals, though.
VHS tapes.
And I would also say, look around you, because in San Francisco, you're probably never more than a mile from a local bike store, not a chain. And even though I've had good luck buying from the chains, when I had to buy bikes for my kids, that's where I went to buy them Schwinn reissues. But I'm also a big believer in supporting the local businesses, which is why I've stumped for Valencia Cyclery so much in this podcast, because I love those guys and they're local and, you know, they deserve to be patronized.
Well, and even if you don't like even if you're not in the market for an expensive for a crazy expensive bike, if you want to get something that's cheap to start or Craigslist or whatever, then you can go. Like they'll take your money to service your bike and make sure that it's safe.
Absolutely.
And they're happy to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They totally will. And their prices for repair are not that much. It's very, very reasonable. And, well,
and I mean, especially if you're buying a used bike, before you get out and get on the road someplace where you're going to be dangerous, you should take it in, get it tuned up, make sure everything's good.
Completely. Yeah. God, no, I am so going on to eBay to look for Cannondale frames after this.
And on that note, you better do it before we post the podcast because they're going to go way up.
Okay.
We will see you guys next week. Thanks for listening. If you would like to support the podcast, you can rate us on iTunes. You can find out about premium memberships at testa.com/premium, all sorts of different stuff. And of course, we have three new podcasts. We have Creature Geek with Frank Ippolito and Len Peralta, special effects podcast. It's
I gotta
great.
Go.
Okay.
Bye, guys.
Bye.